Welcome back to the Daily Drum on 96.3 WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant. This is the Insight segment. Well, there is no debating that police have a certain amount of power, and it comes with the job. But today, following the death of George Floyd and other African Americans at the hands of police, that power is being questioned like never before. If you are black, criticism of policing in America is coming from all sides. Not just being black, just criticism is coming from all sides. And that criticism does not bypass black officers. Are they caught in the middle? Do they support the calls for reform, or do they think things are going too far? We're going to talk about that and more tonight, as it is part one of our two-night discussion on policing. We are talking with those wearing the badge tonight, and tomorrow we'll talk with those pushing for reforms. Our phone lines are open. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Again, we'd like to hear from you. The phone lines are open. We'd like you to be part of our conversation tonight. So we are going to begin with our guests tonight who are joining us. On the phone lines with us is Captain Sonia Pruitt. She is the chairperson of the National Black Police Association. And Clyde Boatwright, vice president of the Maryland State Fraternal Order of Police. Thank you both so much for joining us tonight.
Good evening. Thank you for having me, and thank you to your listeners for tuning in.
Thank you so much. And Captain Pruitt, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm going to start with you, Captain Pruitt. So much is happening. It's moving fast. I mean, we see things on the news today. The police chief of Minneapolis coming out making a statement in terms of what's happening with the union there. What are your thoughts on what is happening and how the police are being portrayed and the movement for reforms that are going across the nation today?
So being Howard alum, I probably have a much different vantage point than a lot of officers. And
okay. Then
being a black officer, I also have that vantage point. And then being a black female officer, I am not surprised. This has been something that should have been addressed, this abuse of police powers since decades ago. And so here we are now. Someone telling us that, you know, finally we get to see what we told you your lying eyes were actually watching. And so I think it is appropriate that we are in this time, and it could not be more urgent, and that the police reforms that are being talked about and that our legislators are introducing for a bill, for a law, for a resolution, for a movement are appropriate.
Officer Boatwright, what is your position on what's happening and what you see going on across the country?
Yeah, so I think that it's important that we understand that what we witnessed in Minneapolis was a crime. The fact that George Floyd was murdered on camera, we cannot get beyond the fact that that happened in front of us. We understand that there are changes afoot for reform in American policing. And we understand that it has to, you know, at some point we have to listen to the citizens, but also we want to make sure that it's an even discussion and that law enforcement has a seat at the table so that we're able to help shape what that reform looks like.
Both of you are African-American, correct?
Yes.
That's right.
And so do you feel like you have a different perspective on this, say, than other officers who might not be coming from that cultural background? Officer Boatwright, I'll let you go first.
So, the one thing I can always say, for at least 21 years before I was a police officer, I was an African-American male. I grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood in Baltimore City. And so I've seen issues with police and community relations growing up in my community. And that's what sparked the interest in me wanting to be a part of that change, to be the change that I wanted to see. So coming from that perspective, it does give me a different perspective than others may see, because I actually lived it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Captain Pruitt, how about you?
Yes, I would agree. So I always tell people, you know, I'm black first, and I'll be black when I take my uniform off. I'm black when I come home from work every day and take it off. That's not going to change, and neither are my experiences as a black woman. What is really, what stands out for me, though, is my experiences as a black woman inside of policing. I did not know that I wish someone had prepared me for what I was about to face, the challenges and the obstacles, and just it has been a little bit difficult, but it has not been any less rewarding.
So the training, Captain Pruitt, so the training that you go through, right? And I'm not sure how long you're in the academy, before you become a full-fledged officer, if I'm terming that correctly. But the training that you're going through, they don't prepare you for the things that you're facing, or are you talking about facing as an officer and as an African-American person?
I'm talking about the things that I'm facing or have faced, I'm sorry.
Right.
As an African American woman.
I see. Okay.
There's no preparation for that unless someone pulls you aside and says, look, this is what you might encounter.
Mm-hmm. So your experience is so much different, like most women in the workforce. I not being a woman, but really, I would think no matter what profession that you're in, you are going to be facing double, triple, right? You're coming in African-American, you're coming in as a woman, and you're coming in, too, I would think, in a profession that is so male-dominated and historically sort of has that kind of testosterone way sort of thinking. So I'm assuming you're facing all of that, too. Would that be correct?
That would be correct, but it also puts us in a great position to be of the greatest service to the community and to try and help to bridge the gap. I mean, historically, that's what we do as black women. And so once I realized what it was I was dealing with, then I was able to shift my focus and my perspective and my paradigm so that I could be of ultimate service to the community and to my fellow officers.
Yeah. Officer Boatwright, we saw Philonise Floyd, brother of George Floyd. It was less than 24 hours after his brother was laid to rest that he was here in the district at the Capitol speaking before the House Judiciary Committee. And he said in part, listen, I want you to feel my pain. You know, I want to see some systemic change. We've heard this before, change, change, change. But really, it hasn't been the type of change where we really see a big difference. In your experiences and what you've seen over the last several weeks, do you think we will see really any sort of full-throated change in terms of policing and reform in the United States?
Well, I am confident that there will be some substantial reforms for policing. And my heart goes out to Mr. Floyd to have the courage to come out today and speak, knowing full well how it feels to lose a brother to murder. I mean, my brother was murdered in the streets of Baltimore, and I know that pain. So I know that his advocacy and what he's dealing with today. My heart goes out to his family, to the rest of the Floyd family. But here's the reality. What we saw in Minneapolis is not reflective of every police officer and every member of law enforcement that puts on a badge and a uniform that goes out there to serve and protect.
Okay.
That was the exception and not the rule. What happened in Minneapolis, we cannot get around what we saw. And in the law enforcement community, I think this is groundbreaking that you're now seeing police officers publicly state that was wrong. And traditionally, you didn't get that kind of response from members of the law enforcement community. They didn't really come out as loud and proud as we are to say, hey, what we saw, we agree with you. We agree that there needs to be some sort of that person needs to be held accountable. But to paint us all with the same brush, that's where we kind of disagree at.
I see. And I want to come back to that about police officers today saying what was wrong and coming out against that, because I want to dive a little bit more into that. But I want to go to the phone lines at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's go to Lois calling from Silver Spring. Lois, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank the police officers for the service that you do.
I appreciate it.
I have a question, though, on a technical matter. The tools that you all use to police, specifically the taser. You're trained in that. You all know the effect it has on the human body, correct?
I think okay. The answer, yeah, that's a rhetorical, but okay. I think they know it.
I'm just saying you're saying yes. But okay, yeah. So when you hold this taser on somebody and you do it multiple times, aren't you going to have a fatal incident after that? Do you all know that? That's my biggest question, because I've seen videos and I'm watching people be constantly tased, and in the outcome I see the people die. So I'm just wondering, do the police officers being trained know this?
All right. Thank you so much, Lois. I'll let you go first on that, Sonia. How much training is there with the taser? And as Lois said, do police really know what it can do to suspects if they use it incorrectly? Really, seems like what we see all too often.
Yeah, that would be a yes. If you are carrying a taser, then the assumption should be that you have been appropriately and properly trained. And after the many incidents that we've had in the country where people did not survive taser incidents, that should be a focal point of training for any police department, both large and small.
And Clyde, why is it we just saw recently in Fairfax County here in the area that this officer who tased this man had it on his neck? Now, the man survived. The officer subsequently said, oh, I thought he was a criminal who was someone else that he misidentified. But just in terms of the training, when you see that and your eyes see it, you go, my goodness, doesn't that officer know holding that taser up against this man's neck what it can do? Or is that officer in that moment just afraid and is sort of losing focus? I know we can't get into his head or others who've done the same.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what that officer would be thinking at that time, so I wouldn't be qualified to speak on that. But
right.
let's talk about the fact that that's a less than lethal option that is available to police officers. That's a new piece of technology that we didn't have 20 years ago when I started policing.
Mm-hmm.
Our profession is evolving, and that tool is now available as an option outside of the pepper spray, outside of the expandable baton. Outside of the firearm, you now have this electronic control device that you can use in multiple ways, whether it's a contact tase, which is what you saw in that video. It's a contact tase. And then there's also the prongs to where fish hooks will attach to the skin and the clothing and develop and it will then issue the same shock that the contact tase will do as well. So that is a new tool. And it's still being evaluated. But when you start to look at these cases and you peel the onion back to these use of force cases involving a taser that results in death, you'll start to see that the common denominator in that is prior health, pre-existing health condition. And people do not have a billboard on their body that says to them, says to the police officer that that person has a pre-existing health condition. So therefore, the taser is not recommended at that time.
Okay, good point. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight, the first of our two-part discussion, we're talking about policing tonight, talking with officers who serve, specifically African-American officers, and the issues that they are facing day in, day out, but especially how those issues are heightened now following the death of George Floyd, following the death of unarmed black men and women that we're seeing now via video. We know this is not new, but we are now seeing it in living color often. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before we bump over to the other side, Officer Pruitt and Boatwright, I want to make sure that we also talk about this issue of defunding, and I want to be sure that I put it in the proper context. I know the term is being used, defunding, but in some ways it's sort of a misnomer. It's a redirecting of funds from the police force, sometimes into community development and different programs that many cities are asking for. We see it in 12, maybe at least a half dozen cities already are redirecting funds away from the police force into other areas. Captain Pruitt, what do you think about that? And do you also believe the term defunding is sort of putting a negative light on sort of reappropriating dollars away from the police department?
Huh. I think that the term defunding, I guess it depends on who sees the term. There are people who are offended by it. I personally am not, because I understand what it means when we talk about reallocation of funds. Mm-hmm. Just like I understand that disbanding a force may mean reorganizing your police department.
But so language does. Language does matter, don't you think, Captain Pruitt? Mm-hmm. Because you're on the inside and you know. And so when you get into semantics, if folks don't know kind of what you know on the inside, they hear defunding, and they go, "Wait a minute, we're just going to take money out of the police force." Mm-hmm. So wouldn't you see how in the sort of the layman out there would kind of get confused where you wouldn't?
Actually, I was speaking as a regular citizen when I said that I'm okay with the word defunding. As a police officer,
but come on, Officer Pruitt, you know you can't just take yourself out of being an officer what you already know, right?
No, well, what I can do is I can live in both worlds simultaneously.
Okay.
So I get that people who are part of law enforcement are the vast majority of people who do not like the word, because it sounds like you're going to take away all our money.
Right.
But this gives us an opportunity to actually talk about it and what it actually means.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime that there is an opportunity for that, I think we should take it. And this is just personal, I'm not afraid of words. And I understand how important words are, especially, coming from the Howard family.
Right.
But it grabs your attention. It makes you open your eyes and your ears. And now we have you, and now we can talk about what this actually means.
All right. We got about a minute, Officer Boatwright, before we jump over to the other side. But I want to get your thoughts on that, too, this sort of defunding, redirecting funds.
I know I have a minute. I'm going to try to wrap it up, but I would like more time on defunding. That's an important topic.
We can pick it up on the other side, but just for the folks on the HUR side, I want to make sure they hear your thoughts.
Sure. I'll start by saying, if you look at the historical context of that, defunding of rec centers occurred by politicians. Mm-hmm. Defunding of schools occurred by politicians. Now they want to discuss defunding of police departments. That's fine, but it goes back to the systemic issues that are plaguing our communities, poor schools, poor recreation centers, lack of investment in communities. That leads to the crime rate, that leads to increased contacts with the police. So these same people that started the problem now want to come along and fix the problem. We have angry crowds yelling for defunding police and let's get rid of all cops, let's police ourselves in our own community. And if we start to do that, then we will start to see more cases like Lon Aubrey case, where you have vigilantes taken to the street and taking the law into their own hands. So we have to be cautious about what we're saying and the message that we're putting out going against law enforcement, because we are the people that are standing in the gap to protect the citizens.
Important points coming from those who wear the uniform and the badge. We're going to continue this conversation. Nate, if you're on the line, stay right there. And if you haven't called in yet, we want to hear from you. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810 tonight, our part one of our conversation on policing and reforms. We will continue this conversation on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm with Angela Stribling is next on 96.3 WHUR. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment, and tonight we are talking about policing today. What is happening? What are officers facing? And specifically, African-American officers. A lot of criticism coming the way of officers following the death of George Floyd and other instances of African-Americans losing their lives at the hands of police. But we also know that police serve in a very, very dangerous profession. We appreciate their service, especially the good ones. And I think we've got two good ones on with us tonight, helping us with this conversation. We want you to be part of it. The phone lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Joining us tonight is Officer Clyde Boatwright. He's the Vice President of the Maryland State Fraternal Order of Police, and Captain Sonia Pruitt, Chairperson of the National Black Police Association. If you're on the phone line, Nate is there. We're going to go to him right now. He has a question or comment. Go right ahead, Nate.
I just wanted to ask the question, as it seems like we might be losing the real issue when it comes to black officers. We're talking about black officers versus white officers and the treatment that black people receive as to being arrested and being suspected and the whole nine versus what we get from black officers. I'm also talking about the history. I'm thinking about the history of policing in America.
Nate, we're losing you a bit. I don't know if you're moving around with your phone, but just because of that, I want to make sure I get your question. What's your specific question, or is it a comment? Just the relationship of blacks to the police force?
As it relates to black police and black suspects,
okay,
versus white police and black suspects, and also the history of policing in America, as I hear these officers eluding the issue of being a black officer and dealing with black suspects, and also acknowledging how white officers deal with black suspects.
Okay, I think I may know where you're going. Officer Pruitt and Officer Boatwright, I think maybe what Nate is saying in just that relationship, and I might paraphrase for him, is there a difference? Do you have to approach your policing differently as an African-American when you are dealing with other African-Americans? Can you allow yourself to do that? Are you trained to do that? Do you naturally do that? Officer Boatwright, I'll start with you.
That's actually the reverse of what I was saying.
Well, I guess we weren't clear. So what is it that you're saying?
I'm talking about them acknowledging how white officers deal with black, I don't even want to call them suspects because we all suspect, but we can do that.
I still don't think you're being very clear, but let me see if I've got this. You want them to address the manner in which white officers deal with African American suspects and what they think of that. Would that be correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let me let them go with that. Officer Boatwright, do you want to sort of attack that?
Yeah. So I'll say this. We're starting to see a lot of one of the most helpful tools in policing and American policing right now is the body camera. We're starting to now see thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of body camera footage of police contact. And there are a few times that we see police contact where there was something, and I don't know whether it's racism or a veiled racism or an inherent racism. I don't know what that is that caused the stop to go differently than it has gone with other people. So is there a problem with that particular officer or that particular individual? To summarize my statement, there are thousands of hours of footage where the stop goes regular and everything goes fine, and nothing is ever said about that. But then we have these outliers, these, you know, one or two incidents that are now magnified, and we're treating it as though it's a problem across the board with everyone.
So how do you
see that in police?
Yeah. So how do you change that, Officer Boatwright? And I think that's an important point that you bring up. I guess that's like that in anything in life, right? Especially when you're in the public eye, that you can have a thousand things go right, and when one thing goes bad, that gets highlighted. So who cares, who wants to hear about, hey, I had 99 traffic stops today,
sure,
and I had no problems with any of those people that I stopped, but I had this one incident where either, you know, the officer sort of lost focus for a minute or something else happened. So how do you even change that? Is that possible? How do you get out to the public?
I don't think so. I don't think you can easily get away from it because people immediately assume, based on the demographics, the racial demographics, that it has to be some sort of racism because the demographics are different.
Okay.
And those different stops.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't think that you could change a person's mind if they see a Caucasian officer versus a black suspect, or African-American suspect. If you see the difference, there's an automatic assumption that there's racism, and that may not have been the case in that particular case, in that particular situation.
And Officer Pruitt, I will give you just sort of a personal interaction. I was on Facebook and I had a high school friend. He posted something and he said, following the Chauvin George Floyd incident, and he said, you know, he acknowledged that what the officer did was wrong, but he said, how do we know, to Officer Boatwright's point, this is racism? You know, and my reply was, well, actually, we really don't know, but we can contextualize and say that historically we've seen these kinds of incidents, and so we sort of put that in the mix and go, it's more likely than not that it has racism wrapped in it somewhere. But to Officer Boatwright's point, do you find that being, you know, an issue that you have to wrestle with of, you know, how do you sort of keep looking at these as just isolated incidents that we don't know if it's racism, but then folks are telling you as a black officer, you know that was racism, right? If it's a black and a white.
So respectfully to Mr. Boatwright, I don't need to see body-worn camera video to know that systemic racism is an issue within policing. Plus, I did work in internal affairs, and so I have my own experiences about what I see on body-worn camera video.
Okay.
We need to stop minimizing the issue. It is a race issue at its core. And if we don't acknowledge it, we cannot do anything about it. I mean, I heard Mr. Boatwright say something about the politics of all of this. But, you know, unions have their interests also. And I have yet to hear anyone in a union say, or anyone leading a union say, not only was this wrong that Mr. Floyd was murdered, but we cannot stand for any more disparate treatment of the black community, any more abuses, any more traumas of this community. It's been going on for long enough. And although I'm seeing officers kneeling and putting their fists up in the air, I need someone to tell me at least, or tell the people that I represent in the National Black Police Association, exactly why are you kneeling and why do you have your fist up? This is not a one-off.
So Officer Boatwright, we, you know, to what Captain Pruitt has said, the police chief in Minneapolis today, right, holding a press conference saying, listen, for right now, I'm going to suspend negotiations with the union. Didn't say he wouldn't go back in and have those negotiations. But for now, he says, you know, I'm going to suspend them because they don't want to move really on some of these reforms that we need. And we should, you know, note that Chief Arredondo is African-American and has the backing of the mayor. But he has said that the union is getting in the way of police reforms. And the previous police chief apparently has gone on record saying the union there in Minneapolis is in the way of police reform. So even if you're a union supporter, does that put police unions in kind of a dicey position now if they're pushing back against reforms, or do you have to sort of dig deeper into what that particular reform looks like in that particular city or town or state?
Well, and I think that this is a very, very good topic to discuss within this, because what gets lost in the fact is a lot of police chiefs, sheriffs, and appointed leaders of police departments fail to acknowledge their faults in this case as well. What happened in Minneapolis, that's the case that we're talking about, and then we could talk about the global perspective. What happened in Minneapolis was a failure. You had four police officers respond to a call for a forgery or passing of bad bills. Do we even know if Mr. Floyd knew that the $20 bill was a bad $20 bill? You don't know. But you have four police officers. That's a failed policy of leadership. Secondly, you had one police officer who's a training officer with two trainees with a total of 4 days on the job. That's a failed. That's failed leadership. You don't put one training officer with two trainees at the same time. So you had trainees following the direction of their training officer. That's a leadership problem. That's not a union problem. And so it's easy to pass off the issues to the union and say that the union are getting in the way of reforms. The union's responsibility is pay benefits and working conditions. That's what unions fight for, pay benefits and working conditions. We are the voice of the police officers. We are the ones that make sure that the officer gets due process. We're not standing in the way of good cops versus bad cops or anybody. As long as the officer gets due process, then the union has done its job. And that's what gets lost in translation when leaders dump it on the police unions, and that's not the case.
And so I take it that you believe that Chief Arredondo is kind of passing the buck. Would I be assessing that correctly?
Well, it's easy to pass the buck because he's an at-will employee, and that the mayor can say his services are no longer needed tomorrow. So I'll dump it off on the union, and then you have police chiefs jumping around the nation. I saw a police chief laying down on the ground yesterday and simulating George Floyd And yet he had an Indian chief on his uniform patch. So you want to address what happened here, but your own police department is not addressing their clearly they have some issues within their past that they have an Indian chief on their patch. So if you want to talk about it, let's stop pandering and giving platitudes. Let's talk about the real issues. It's leadership, and that starts from the top.
But Officer Pruitt, wouldn't you say, I guess, Officer Boatwright, I hear what you're saying. But when I saw the video of the officer, the chief in New York kneeling, and I saw the officer hugging protesters, and I saw that in other cities, and I saw officers kneeling, and we can talk about the Colin Kaepernick and how kneeling all of a sudden took on a negative tone. And, you know, my general sense, Officer Pruitt, is when I saw that, I thought, okay, that's at least a good thing. That's at least an acknowledgement that, you know, let's figure out a way to work together and now move forward to policy. Am I being naive on that? Because that sounds a little like Officer Boatwright is like, I don't need to see that. You know, I need to see accountability from the top. What would be your take on what we've seen some of these heads of departments doing out in the streets with protesters trying to show solidarity?
Hey, so I'm pretty sure that there are officers out there from all different backgrounds that are in support of this uprising, because that is what we have. I, too, as I have expressed, am skeptical, probably for different reasons than Officer Boatwright. But, you know, Officer Boatwright over here sounded like a politician himself talking about the union and pay benefits and working conditions. I need unions to stay in their lane, because just I'm pretty sure people who are listening saw the video of O'Meara. He's the head of the New York State Police Association. I don't know what mm-hmm. they call it. And he talked about people are comparing the police to thugs. Thugs being dog whistle for the N-word. That's right. The new N-word. They don't, you know, they don't talk about thugs being white criminals. It's always the black person who they describe as thugs. And so when we know, this is a whole lot of things that we're going to have to address, but I don't think that the unions can pull back and make it about leadership, although leadership is also an issue. And mm-hmm. from my vantage point, leadership is an issue when you refuse to hold police officers accountable for what it is that they are doing wrong, for misconduct, which is why people are calling for the nation to step in, the federal government, to step in and give us some laws and some legislation that is consistent across the board all over the country for use of force and that sort of thing.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation. It is important. We've got two officers joining us. We want you to be part of this conversation. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The men and women wearing blue, African-Americans in particular, those officers, how are they dealing with all that is going on in the United States today? We're going to continue our conversation right after this quick timeout. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on HRR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment, and tonight we are talking about what the African-American officers, police officers in particular, are facing during this tumultuous time that we have right now in America. Police are metaphorically under fire right now, and police reform is being pushed all across the nation in police departments in towns, big and small, cities and states. And tonight we're talking about that. Our guest, Captain Sonia Pruitt, chairperson of the National Black Police Association, and Clyde Boatwright, vice president of the Maryland State Fraternal Order of Police. Our phone lines are still open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'd like to hear your questions, your comments about what is happening out there today and your thoughts on policing and especially African-American officers. We're going to go back to those phone lines now. Simon is calling from the District Heights in Maryland. Go right ahead, Simon, with your question or comment.
Good afternoon. Good evening. I want to thank all the officers in the studio for their service. I know it's a very risky job. I understand that. But my question is about police training, and it's also about the police being looked at as some as a very important institution in the country and for the community. So there's this image of our police that runs out that when a policeman in the U.S. in general takes his gun, it is about shooting and to kill. We have seen that several times in the videos, on many social media platforms. So the question is really, is there another way for the police to be well-trained so that when they touch their gun, it's not really just to shoot and kill?
Okay. Thank you so much, Simon. Captain Pruitt, I'm assuming that you aren't trained to shoot to kill, but Simon seems to have that perception. Is that part of the problem, just the perception of the public, that when an officer pulls out his or her gun, they're shooting to kill?
Yeah, that is exactly how we are trained. If you're pulling out your gun to use it, then you are going to be using deadly force. There are some cases in which an officer may display their gun, and it's not necessarily against any protocol or policy, but if you are pulling it out to pull the trigger, then you are definitely pulling it out to kill someone, not to hurt them, not to shoot them in the leg or in the arm. But what I will say is this. I'm concerned about the level of fear that I hear articulated by officers who are involved in deadly force incidents. I want to know. Somebody should do a study and sit people down, officers or ex-officers down who have been involved in deadly force incidents and ask them exactly what it is that they were fearful of. We all know that race-based incidents, the core of those is fear. So, again, here is your proof that there is a deeper and systemic issue with policing than just, every once in a while here and there something happens.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an experience where you've, and I'll put this out to both of you, where you've spoken to an officer who's been in a situation where either the end result was that someone, you know, died, or that they were reacting from a sense of fear? And if so, how did they express that to you? Why? I'll let you finish your thought, Officer Pruitt, if you've had that experience with others.
I have, but not in situations where I thought that, you know, that was unnecessary. Because just because shootings are justified doesn't mean that they're necessary. So I have not had a conversation with anyone who was involved in something that I thought was an unnecessary use of deadly force.
I see. Officer Boatwright, have you had that experience, that kind of conversation with anyone that you've been associated while you were in the force?
Yes. So I have been the first person to respond to a shooting after an officer discharged their weapon and had a direct conversation with the officer and realized that, you could tell the fear that they were under, you know, that they were dealing with, because it was still apparent when I got there and the situation was calm. Mm-hmm. So there are situations where people are really, really fearful. And I agree with Captain Pruitt when it talks about all, if you look at the if you break down these situations, it goes back to fear, because we need training of mindfulness, training of cultural diversity, training of de-escalation. Those, if you look at the national best practices, what happens is cities don't want to fund that. They don't want to fund the training and the time that it takes to get the officers properly trained, to cultural competencies, to see if you have implicit bias. You know, we all have biases that we don't even know about that. And I didn't know about some of my biases until I went through the training. You know, and the training puts you through those scenarios. And, you know, there are best practices in policing. From what I hear, a lot of people want a standard, an overall standard across the board. But you're going to have to get buy-in from local states and from local municipalities and also states to get on board with that, if we're going to do a across-the-board standard when it comes to policing and training.
I want to ask both of you this, and I'll let you address it first, Captain Pruitt. Is there this sort of code among police officers that you protect the back of a police officer no matter what? And if there is an incident that's being questioned, that you do not, I mean, let's just use the words of the street, you don't snitch. Is that real? How prevalent is it still, if it is? And if it is real, how hard will it be to change that? Officer Pruitt, could you address that?
So I'm also an associate professor at Montgomery College. I teach a class, an introductory class in criminal justice, and I opened up the textbook when I first got the new one, and there wasn't a whole chapter on police culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an acknowledgement that police culture exists. And yes, I would say that there is an element of that that speaks to loyalty for some people, but for me, it speaks to shutting people up. You know, you don't say anything. You back the blue, the thin blue line. You know. I liken it to a gang. And, you know, some people lose their individuality when they become the police. That could be a good thing if your element, the element that was embracing you, is good and just and true, and there was equity and no imbalance in the power dynamic. But that's not what we're talking about here. So it is problematic, and to release those claws is going to take a lot of work, but I think we've started the work now with what's going on in the country.
And how do you see it, Officer Boatwright? Is it real, this code?
Well, there is a culture within policing that people put up this wall. However, I will say this, and it's been my experience, and this is the image that I put out there and portray, and I have always done it in my career. Don't do anything around me that would lead you to believe that I'm going to lie for you. Because when I get fired, I can't come move my family in your house and live with you.
Okay.
So I'm not protecting you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do something around me, we're going to talk about the truth. And so and that goes to, and that doesn't have to be a widespread thing amongst law enforcement. People have to self-discipline themselves. They have to discipline themselves first and have integrity and ethics and morals within themselves first before you can even go out and try to service anyone else. So it starts with them.
And that seems like part of the issue when we're talking about reform, and we'll talk a little bit more tomorrow night, and that is trying to sort of weed out those folks before they even come into the departments. And obviously that's just a whole another issue. Before we run out of time, Kevin has been waiting on the line. I know we only have a few moments left. He has a comment regarding African-American officers. Go right ahead, Kevin, quickly.
Yes. I wanted to address Officer Boatwright. First of all, about the union, he said that the union was basically set up to ensure due and fair process for officers. When I myself, who has a brother who lost his job with the Metropolitan Police Department and was told by union officials, had he only been on the force 4 more months, then his probationary period would have been up. And then he would have never lost his job. So it's not about due process. They don't care what he did to get in the situation he was in. They were still going to represent him and try to keep him on the force. And this is my own blood brother I'm speaking of. And then
Kevin, I'm gonna have to leave it there because the music is playing. But that's something maybe we can pick up tomorrow regarding police reform. And sorry, Officer Boatwright, you don't have time to sort of address that. And I know it's an individual issue that you probably really couldn't get too far into anyway without knowing all of the details. But I want to thank Officer Clyde Boatwright, Vice President of the Maryland State Fraternal Order of Police, and Captain Sonia Pruitt, Chairperson of the National Black Police Association and proud alum of Howard University. You see how I got that in there?
Thank you
both so much for being with us. That
thank
is the daily.
Well.
Thank you, Officer Boatwright. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday. I'm losing my days. June 10th. I'm Bramonte Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Make sure you join us tomorrow night where we take on part 2 of this conversation when we talk about police reform. Have a great night.